Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Paul Horsted has been making photographs for more than 35 years. He's traveled the back roads and highways of South Dakota. He's hiked and climbed and crawled his way to capture images for five coffee table books that explore the beauty of today and the history of yesterday. His latest book is called Treasures of the National Parks, Yesterday and Today. You can see him at the Journey Museum in Rapid City on December 17th. But first, he joins us on the phone now from Custer. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hey, Lori. It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Are there other events coming up? I have the Journey Museum, and then it seems to me that there might be more for you this holiday season.
A couple of things. Thanks for asking. December 2nd, I'll be at Art Expressions Art Gallery right here in Custer, where I live, and then also December 23 over in Sioux Falls for your last-minute shopping at Zambro's Variety. I'll be doing a book signing there in the afternoon of to Saturday, December 23rd.
Fabulous. This is an incredible book, astonishingly beautiful.
Well, thank you.
And what a project. 4 years of planning and research and traveling and writing and book designing and all this. Give me an idea of, let's start with the readers.
Sure.
And how over five books the readers have continued to support you in a way that lets you do that next project.
Yeah, my wife, Camille Reiner, my wife and book designer, and I have been doing this now for going on 17 years. Our first book, Exploring with Custer, the 1874 Black Hills Expedition, that's when I kind of fell in love with this idea of trying to set my camera exactly where an early photographer did and recreate that scene and just kind of see what's there, what disappeared, what remains, and learn about history. And some of those photo sites were just a mile or so from my house here north of Custer, and that's what drew me into that story. And as you said, our readers supported that notion in a big way, and we published these books ourselves as well. And so each of these books has been built on the previous one, and that led into an entire book on the Black Hills then called The Black Hills Yesterday and Today, which 150 other sites around the hills from Harney Peak to Deadwood to, you know, the gold rush into the early tourism era. And I, again, just following this niche I'd found, went out to Yellowstone and met a guy out there that had been collecting pictures for 30 years of Yellowstone National Park, our first national park. And that's kind of where I put my toe in the water for the project that we've just completed. He and I, Bob Berry out in Cody, did a book called Yellowstone Yesterday and Today, where we found 100 more sites around Yellowstone to kind of show past and present there. And that was 7 years ago already, and then we put that book out, and then I've been working on this one since that time. So we're glad to have it out there and available for our faithful readers who we couldn't do this without.
Why do it this way? Why not seek, you know, a major funding or, you know, a funding source or grants? You know, when you look back at this really incredible body of work, it's kind of remarkable that you've done this so far and still going.
Yeah.
Strong for sure, but you've done it without, you know, some sort of major funder driving it.
Yeah, I guess it's probably boils down to I'm not that organized to get that sort of funding lined up. I don't always know where I'm going to end up, so it's always been difficult for me to tell somebody in advance exactly what I'm going to come up with, you know. And I've always liked, as a photographer starting out back in the 70s and 80s, shooting work and then selling it. You know, I did some assignment work where somebody is doing hiring you to do that sort of thing and then create something based on what they think you can do. But I've always liked just doing my own thing and then presenting it and hopefully having it accepted, and if not, move on and try something else. So I also have an independent streak, perhaps, I've done a couple of books where it was designed by committee, you might say, for other publishers elsewhere I won't mention, and just never been very happy with the results. When you get too many heads into a project, sometimes it gets diluted a little bit. So I guess you could say I'm also a control freak. Maybe that's what I really should be saying about myself.
I think a lot of people would look at this and say, though, you have managed to, you know, you're an example of a business model where you do have control of your career in some ways, and that's a real positive thing for folks to look toward.
Well, I really feel blessed, you know, despite what I said a minute ago, to be able to do this. Yeah. We live in a time and place where, you know, technology allowed us to do that. First book, Desktop Publishing, had, you know, come to the the home office, and my wife Camille had been teaching graphic design for a number of years at that point, was an early Macintosh computer user, and I'd still be pounding away on a typewriter if she hadn't gotten me into the computer age. And so, you know, just that capability that a couple, three people, we have a good editor, Ernie Graffy, and my co-authors on the Custer Expedition books, I should mention Ernie Graffy and John Nelson on those two books. But, you know, just a very small circle, you can put something out that, you know, in all modesty, I would put up right against, you know, anything that's out there from any of these publishers.
Yeah, I would absolutely concur with that. Let's talk a little bit about this project itself and the years that it took to put it together with the national parks. What sort of advancements in your own skill and in the technology accessible to you really made this sort of a project possible?
Well, you know, the challenge is finding the location, finding historic photos, I guess would be the first thing to use as raw material, and then finding the location where the picture was taken and then executing the photo. You can kind of break it down that way. And so finding the historic photos, just thanks to online services like the Library of Congress, the Geological Survey, have posted photos that their expeditions and photographers who registered their copyrights back in the 1800s put these government organizations have scanned these in and put them online for anybody to use. So those were good resources. And then also, it's kind of funny, but I write in the book about eBay, just the auction site eBay. I was
right.
able to purchase, yeah, many historic photos for just a few dollars. In some cases, I paid a lot more than that for some of them that I really wanted to use. But was able to develop my own library of historic images of the national parks. And then projecting the sites of those photos, I don't want to make it sound easy because, you know, there were difficulties, but a lot of times I could sort of figure out where the picture had been taken by using Google Earth. So over the winter, let's say, before I was going out in a summertime shoot, I would try to project the sites of these photo sites by looking at the background of the image and then looking in Google Earth and kind of seeing, okay, might have been on this ridge or at this overlook or in this road system. And I could put those into my GPS, and then I could navigate to those locations, you know, hopefully successfully, not always. But and then finally at the location, after all the travel and driving and hiking, setting up my camera in the last few inches of precision, I hope, right where the other photographer had set up his camera. I used a laptop computer, and I could beam the photos over to the laptop and compare it right there while I was standing at the site with the old photo. I also carried hard copies in my hand, but that last part of that, being able to look at it on the computer, I could see literally if I was off by just a few inches and scooched the camera forward or backward. And it sounds like overkill, but sometimes there's things right in the foreground of these images that pop up, like a dead tree stump or, you know, a rock or a boulder or something like that, where you go, wow, there's that same tree, you know, from 140 years ago. And that's, I guess, you know, why I call this a treasure hunt. You never quite know what you're going to find when you get there.
There has to be a moment when it all lines up and you just have everything exactly the way you want it to, where you stand there and realize that your feet are on the same spot of the photographer who took that image. What is that moment like for you when it's all working?
Yeah, it's, you know, that's, I've written about this before in our other books. It's kind of where your hair goes up on, and you expect to look around and see their hat or gloves or something laying there. I mean, it really is like stepping into history. And that's the experience I guess I'm looking for myself, as well as sharing with our readers. And we do put GPS coordinates in all our books so people can, you know, navigate to these places or follow Custer's trail or whatever it is. And, you know, that's what I'm trying to share, I think, in the books with our readers, is that experience of discovery and the idea that you are stepping into history a little bit. And, you know, it may be a place out in Yosemite, for example, or Yellowstone, where, you know, millions of people have stood since that time. But when that photographer was there, he may have been, you know, not maybe the first person ever to do that there, or possibly, you know, after a few other visitors had been there. But some of these photo sites go back, into the 1860s, really, you know, ancient in the terms of photography. And so it was definitely a different world back then. And so I think you can kind of step back into that a little bit with these photo sites. And that's what I enjoy about it.
What have you learned about the individual photographers or photography of that time when you stand in different places or look where they positioned a subject right next to a cliff or something? Like,
sure,
what did you learn about what they were after?
Well, I learned that they had little fear of heights. put it that way. There's a lot of places, you know, the Grand Canyon, and you just wonder what, you know, what they were thinking. I mean, there were a couple of sites I passed on, and I can't be sure if something has changed since they were there 150 years ago. Maybe that site is more dangerous to stand at now than it was back then. There may have been a tree in the way, or, you know, the cliff is eroded or something. But besides that, I learned about their techniques. They were always looking for a place to set the camera on a tripod, of course, because back in the glass plate era, the exposures were usually, you know, at least a second or two, and sometimes several seconds long. So they needed a stable, flat location. So sometimes I'll literally, you know, I'm looking for the spot, and I'm kind of think I'm zeroing in on it within a few feet, and then I'll see sort of a flat boulder area, you know, next to water or whatever, where they could have placed the tripod, and I stand there, and I can tell then right away that I'm literally exactly where they were set up. And then you just have to find the elevation, and typically they set their cameras at about eye height. You know, today we look for unusual angles, high or low, you know, when we're doing creative photography, but back then you basically shot everything from eye level. So I have had the experience of actually being able to tell the photographer was a little shorter. I've seen multiple sites by guy. You know, it is interesting that you can get it to that level.
Do you then take your own shots from, you know, more contemporary, you know, angles at the same time, or are you really primarily interested in capturing it exactly as it was?
You know, it's hard to resist, you know, passing through all this beauty everywhere in national parks, you know, so I try to appreciate that and take a few of my own pictures. There's such a mass of wonderful photography of our national parks now. Everybody with a cell phone is doing stuff that would have passed in National Geographic, you know, 25 years ago. It's, you know, the whole art of photography has been, you know, been made much more approachable and by everybody, and I think that's wonderful. So I don't spend a lot of time shooting thinking I'm going to make a living off of those other landscape photos, you know what I might say, but the idea of passing any of that, I do try to do my own shots. I know I skipped a couple of bear traffic jams in Yellowstone just because I was trying to get to that next historic photo site. It is a time-saving thing to do that, but I certainly appreciate the beauty around me as I'm doing this.
Let's talk about some of the people in the photographs as I'm looking through the book. And if you're just tuning in, the book we're talking about is Treasures of the National Parks, Yesterday and Today. My guest, Paul Horsted, we're reaching him in Custer. And, you know, some of those historic photographs will have people sort of off to the side or sitting there or standing and looking at the camera. And then in some of your photographs, you don't restage people in that place, but in other photos, there might be a person off to the side. And it's so fascinating to sort of see the difference in the humans, you know, kind of walking through the shot.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how you think about people in these photos?
Sure. You know, I love seeing as you mentioned, the old-time tourists, you know, sometimes caught in candid moments and then other times clearly posed by the photographer. Especially there seems to be a desire to pose people on the edge of cliffs, you know, on Zion National Park and Bryce Canyon. I remember there's a cowboy standing on top of pinnacles and, you know, just crazy safety issues, you might say. But you do still see that today. And I think there were a couple of times where I asked a hiker. I was way out in the backcountry of Glacier and, you know, I'm all by myself typically, but, you know, sometimes somebody would come by and it just really added an element to have somebody. I would tell them what I'm doing and say, just go stand over there wherever you're comfortable and do what you'd normally do. And so I did a very little bit of that, but I tried to just shoot candid. And in our national parks, at any of the overlooks, there's always somebody coming along. So I would just try to get my camera set up in the proper location and then just let time pass and see what went in front of me, whether it was the lighting changing or clouds or people coming and going. There's one in the Grand Canyon where in the old photo, the characters in the historic photo are sitting on the edge of the cliff and looking over the edge, and it looks a little spooky. And I set up looking at that spot from some distance away, and just a progression of people came along and did exactly the same thing, sat down with their legs hanging over the edge, you know. And the one that went in the book is a guy with a GoPro camera on his head looking over the edge of the canyon. And He was safe, but I mean, it was a long ways down, you know, but it does. So we're just trying to enjoy these parks the same way that people did back in the day.
And it teaches you a little something about human nature as well.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
So let's talk about the journey, because, again, I'm really fascinated with this notion of, you know, sort of standing there and realizing this photographer is taller or shorter than I am. You know, they were gutsy and maybe risky. perhaps if the terrain is the same as it is today. But also you have these hours and hours and days of travel, which would connect you with them as well, that they were getting to these places, and you have to get there.
Right. The obstacles they went over to get their cameras where they went in some cases is pretty remarkable. And, on the one hand, there were photographers who lived in Yosemite, for example, or Yellowstone for decades, and shot repeatedly through the seasons and everything. And I'm trying to get there at a specific window, where the airplane or car or hiking can get me there. And so they did maybe have an advantage in some ways by just virtue of residency at these national parks. But others were just coming and going, kind of like I'm doing. So I see pictures where there's people riding horses and mules, and that's sort of a clue that that's their transportation back then. Hmm. Certain locations where you're not allowed to do that now. I mean, the Park Service, for example, doesn't want, a lot of horse traffic, let's say, in certain areas. So I'm going on foot, and so it does take some time, driving across the country, which I really enjoy. I did drive out to the West Coast several times in the Southwest, but also flew and then rented a car and drove to the rim of the canyon or Zion or Bryce and then hiked, as necessary from there. So I guess we both had in the old days and now certain advantages, but also obviously I've got a lot easier in terms of the portability of the equipment I'm using. I went for the lightest weight Nikon cameras I could find, a couple of lenses and a carbon fiber tripod, which weighs a couple pounds compared to probably a 25-pound tripod they would have been carrying, back in the 1800s. So clearly I have it an easier time than some of these folks did back then.
You know these places now in a way that, most of us who pass through don't know them. Not only are you looking for a particular view, but you're getting there often, as you say, backpacking and, spending days just looking for that view. How did it change you? How did this, 4 years of really doing the travel and being on the ground and, putting Band-Aids on the blisters and what have you, how did it sort of change you at this time in your life?
That's a really good question. I'm in my middle 50s, so I do think about the fact that I won't be able to do this kind of thing forever. I can kind of count how many books I've got left in me. You might even, I kind of think about that once in a while, because each one seems to take 3 to 5 years now, and the way we're doing them anyway, which perhaps isn't the most efficient, but at least I'm happy with the presentation when we're done. But I do have this weird or odd or perhaps just unique, I don't know what the word is, thing about looking at the past. Every time I drive into Custer, I hardly ever fail to realize I'm driving right down the trail where Custer's wagons went. And so I'm kind of thinking about the past and looking at that through that lens of these historic photos. And that's certainly what I was doing out in the parks. I wrote in the book that I felt like I was sort of in this secret world. I'm standing there holding this photo, and there's people running by or passing by on the walkways in certain areas where there were lots of visitors. And I sort of am looking back into the past and suddenly realizing there's that same tree or that boulder and then the waterfall behind it, and this trail wasn't here, and there were cars parked over here back in 1920 that aren't there now, of course. It's something I try to, as I said earlier, share in the book, but it has had an effect on the way I think about the world around me. I'm kind of looking through that lens of the past almost literally, it's just something that's become part of my personality, I guess. And I love speaking about it when I talk to groups. I can really show that because we can fade right from one photo to the other. And you can literally just see, that grow from 6 inches high to a 200-foot, pine tree out in Yellowstone or Yosemite or up in the Olympic Peninsula at Olympic National Park. I guess I'm just continuing to pursue that path and think about that kind of change, and then also what are the links to history that still remain around us today.
Right. You know what I love about this book and all your work is that not only is it a beautiful gift to give somebody, wonderful education, that connection to history that you're talking about, but, the word inspire is maybe a little trite, but it also, influences me as a reader to do something, whatever project it is that you want to do, it's
absolutely
worth it.
Absolutely, yeah.
take the time and do the thing that you want to do, whether it's, you know, traveling or not, but do something, because really taking the time to do it well is worth the journey.
That's certainly something to I think everybody should try to pursue their dream, and that's what I've been able to do, like I said, with the support of our readers and my wife Camille and my daughter Anna supporting me while I was out in the field at various times. They came along at times, but also I was out there by myself, and so I couldn't have done it without them, and I agree completely that try to follow that dream. And they joke about following the dream and the money will follow. You know, it doesn't always happen, but if you try hard enough, I think it can. So it's been a good experience for us.
We hope you will come back to this program again and again. I have so much more I want to talk to you about, but for now, the book is called Treasures of the National Parks, Yesterday and Today. Paul Horsted is the photographer. You can see him December 2nd in Custer at the Art Gallery there, December 17th, 2 p.m. at the Journey Museum for a presentation in Rapid City there, and December 23rd in Sioux Falls at Zambros.
Paul, thanks so much. Yeah, they naturally have them all. Yeah, thank you. They do have the book out at all the national parks, of course, as well. I should have said that, here in South Dakota. So thank you so much. I sure appreciate it.